for my arm and prayed that I was inserting the proper key into the lock. A twist to the left, and I heard the latch slide into the hole. I turned the key back quietly, extracting it with shaking hands, careful not to let the keys jingle together noisily. I glanced back over my shoulder, at the same time looking for an escape route. The hallway extended about 3 feet to the right, where the archway to the living room cut through. At the extreme end of the hall was Moses' bedroom. To my left there was an alcove for the telephone, a closet, the bathroom, and the kitchen, with an archway to the dining room visible beyond that. The dining room, in turn, opened into the living room again. If they were heading back this way, I had to guess they'd come straight through the archway to my right. I took 2 giant steps to the left and slipped into the bathroom. The minute I did it, I knew I'd made a bad choice. I should have tried the kitchen with its outside exit. This was a dead end. There was a separate shower to my immediate left, with an opaque glass door, bathtub adjacent. To my right was a pedestal sink, and next to it the toilet. The only window in the room was small and probably hadn't been opened in years. By now I could hear voices growing louder as Lila moved into the hall. I stepped into the enclosed shower and pulled the door shut. I didn't dare latch it. I was certain the distinct sound of the metallic click would carry, alerting her to my presence. I set the flashlight down and held on to the door from the inside, bracing my fingers against the tile. I sank down to a crouch, thinking that if someone came in, I'd be less conspicuous if I was hunkered down. The voices in the hall bumbled on, and I heard Lila unlock her bedroom door. The shower was still damp from recent use, scented with zest soap. A wash rag hanging over the cold water knob dripped intermittently on my shoulder. I listened intently, but I couldn't hear much. In situations like this, you have to get into the zen of hiding. Otherwise, your knees ache, your leg muscles go into spasms, and pretty soon you lose all sense of caution and just want to leap out shrieking, regardless of the consequence. I leaned my face on my right arm, looking inward. I could still taste the onion from my sandwich. I was longing to clear my throat. Also, I needed to pee. I hoped I wouldn't get caught, because I was going to feel like such an ass if Lila or Henry whipped open the shower door and found me crouching there. I didn't even bother to think up an explanation. There wasn't one. I lifted my head. Voices in the hall. Lila had come out of her room, locking it after her. Maybe she'd gone in to make sure the hairs were in place. I wondered if I should have confiscated the duplicate licenses while I had the chance. No, better that I left them where they were. Suddenly the bathroom door flew back, and Lila's voice echoed against the bathroom walls like a bullhorn. My heart leapt into action so fast it was like being flung in an icy swimming pool. She was right on the other side of the shower door, her plump form vaguely defined through the milky glass. I closed my eyes like a kid, willing myself invisible.
"I'll be right there, dearie love," she sang from 2 feet away.
She crossed to the john, and I heard the rustle of her polyester dress and the snap of her girdle as she struggled with it. "Please, God," I thought, "don't let her decide to take an impromptu shower or a dump." My tension level was so high that I was bound to sneeze, or cough, or groan, or cackle maniacally. I willed myself into a hypnotic state, feeling my armpits dampen with sweat. The toilet flushed. Lila took forever putting herself back together again. Rustle, pop, snap. I heard her jiggle the handle when the toilet continued to run. She washed her hands, the faucet squeaking as she turned it off. How long could she drag this out? Finally, she moved toward the bathroom door and opened it, and then she was gone, footsteps receding toward the living room. Yakety-yak, chit-chat, soft laughter, goodbye sounds, and the front door closed. I stayed exactly where I was until I heard Moza in the hall.
"Kinsey? They're gone. Are you still here?"
I let out the breath I'd been holding and stood up, shoving my flashlight into my back pocket. This is not a dignified way to make a living, I thought. Hell, I wasn't even getting paid for this. I peered out of the shower door, making sure I hadn't been set up in some elaborate ruse. The house felt quiet except for Moza, who was opening the broom closet door, still whispering,
"Kinsey?"
"I'm in here," I said, voice booming. I went out into the hall. Moza was so thrilled we hadn't been caught that she couldn't even get mad at me. She leaned against the wall, fanning herself. I figured I'd better get out of there before they came back for something else, taking 10 more years off my projected lifespan.
"You're terrific," I murmured. "I'm indebted for life. I'll buy you dinner at Rosie's."
I moved through the kitchen, peering out the back door before I exited. It was fully dark by then, but I made sure the street was deserted before I stepped out of the shadow of Moses' house. Then I walked the half block toward home, laughing to myself. Actually, it's fun to horse around with danger. It's fun to snoop in people's dresser drawers. I might have turned to burgling houses if law enforcement hadn't beckoned me first. With Lila, I was finally beginning to take control of a situation I didn't like, and the surge of power made me feel nearly giddy with relief. I wasn't sure what she was up to, but I intended to find out. Chapter 18. When I was safely back in my apartment again, I took out the credit card receipt I'd lifted from Lila's shoebox. The date on it was May 25th, and the store was located in Las Cruces. The credit card imprint read, Delia Sims. In the box marked phone number, someone had obligingly penned in a phone number. I hauled out my telephone book and looked up the area code for Las Cruces. 505. I picked up the receiver and dialed the number, wondering as I heard it ring on the far end just what I intended to say.
"Hello?"
Man's voice, middle-aged, no accent. "Oh, hello," I said smoothly. "I wonder if I might speak to Delia Sims." There was a moment of silence.
"Hang on."
A palm was secured across the mouthpiece, and I could hear muffled conversation in the background. The receiver was apparently taken over by someone else, because a new voice inquired,
"May I help you?"
This one was female, and I couldn't classify the age. "Delia," I said.
"Who is this, please?"
The tone was guarded, as though the call might be obscene. "Oh, sorry," I said. "This is Lucy Stansbury." "That's not you, is it, Delia? It doesn't sound like your voice."
"This is a friend of Delia's. She's not here at the moment. Was there something I might help you with?"
"Well, I hope so," I said, mind racing. "Actually, I'm calling from California. I just met Delia recently, and she left some of her things in the back seat of my car." I couldn't figure out any other way to reach her except to try this number, which was on a credit card receipt for a purchase she made in Las Cruces. "Is she still in California, or is she home again?"
"Just a minute."
Again a palm across the mouthpiece and the drone of conversation in the background. The woman came back on the line.
"Why don't you give me your name and number, and I'll have her get back to you?"
"Oh, sure, that's fine," I said. I gave her my name again, spelling it out laboriously, and then I made up a telephone number with the area code for Los Angeles. "You want me to mail this stuff back to her, or just hang on to it? I'd feel bad if I thought she didn't realize where she'd left it."
"What exactly did she leave?"
"Well, most of it's just clothes. A summer dress I know she's fond of, but I don't guess that matters much. I do have that ring of hers with the square-cut emerald and the little diamond baguettes," I said, describing the ring I'd seen Lila wearing the first afternoon in Henry's garden. "Do you expect her back soon?" After the barest hesitation, the woman's chill reply came.
"Who is this?"
I hung up. So much for trying to fool the folks in Las Cruces. I couldn't imagine what she was up to, but I sure didn't like the notion of this real estate venture she'd proposed to Henry. He was so smitten, she could probably talk him into anything. She was moving quickly, too, and I thought I'd better come up with some answers before she took him for all he was worth. I reached for a pile of blank index cards in my top desk drawer, and when the phone rang moments later, I jumped. Shit, could someone have put a trace on the call that fast? Surely not. I lifted the receiver with caution, listening for the white noise of a long-distance connection. There was none. "Hello?"
"Miss Milhone."
"Male." The voice sounded familiar, though I couldn't for the moment figure out who it was. Music blasting in the background was forcing him to yell, and I found myself yelling too.
"This is she?"
"This is Gus,"
he hollered.
"Bobby's friend from the skate rental place."
"Oh, it's you. Hello. I'm glad you called. I hope you have some information for me. I could sure use the help."
"Well, I've been thinking about Bobby, and I guess I owe him that much. I should have spoken up this afternoon."
"Don't worry about it.
I appreciate your getting back to me. You want to get together or just talk on the phone?
Either way is fine. One thing I wanted to mention, and I don't know if this would be a help or not, but Bobby gave me this address book you might want to take a look at. Did he ever talk to you about that?
Of course he did. I've been turning the town upside down looking for that thing, I said. Where are you?
He gave me an address on Granizo, and I said I'd be right there. I hung up the phone and grabbed my handbag and car keys. Gus's neighborhood was poorly lighted, and the yards were flat patches of dirt, graced with occasional palm trees. The cars parked along the curbs were primer-painted lowriders with bald tires and ominous dents. My VW fit right in. About every third property boasted a brand-new chain-link fence, erected to corral God knows what kind of beast. As I passed one house, I heard something that sounded ugly and snappish scramble forward to the length of its choke chain, whimpering hoarsely when it couldn't quite get to me. I picked up my pace. Gus lived in a tiny frame cottage in a U-shaped courtyard ringed with cottages. I passed through an ornamental entranceway with the street number in wrought iron arched across it in a rainbow shape. There were 8 units altogether, 3 on each side of a central walkway and 2 at the end. All were cream-colored and even in the darkness looked drab with soot. I identified Gus's place because the music thundering out was the same stuff I'd heard on the phone. Up close, it didn't sound as good. His front drape consisted of a bedsheet slung over a curtain rod, and the knob on his screen was an empty wooden spool on a nail. I had to wait for a brief silence between cuts to pound on the doorframe. The music started up again with a vengeance, but he'd apparently caught my knock.
"Yo!" he yelled.
He opened the door and held the screen for me. I stepped into the room, assaulted by heat, loud rock, and the strong smell of catbox.
"Can you turn that shit down?" I yelled.
He nodded, moving to the stereo, which he flicked off.
"Sorry," he said sheepishly. "Have a seat."
His place was about half the size of mine, and jammed with twice the furniture. King-sized bed, a big chest of drawers in pecan wood plastic laminate, the stereo cabinet, sagging brick and board bookcases, 2 upholstered chairs with shredded sides, a space heater, and one of those units the size of a television console, housing sink, stove, and refrigerator. The bathroom was separated from the main room by a panel of material hanging on a length of twine. The room's 2 lamps were draped with red terry cloth towels that muted their 250-watt bulbs to a rosy glow. Both chairs were filled with cats, which he seemed to notice about the same time I did. He gathered one batch of them up by the armload as if they were old clothes, and I sat down in the space he had cleared. As soon as he tossed the cats on the bed, they made their way back to their original places. One of them kneaded my lap as if it were a hunk of bread dough, and then curled up when he was satisfied with the job he'd done. Another one crowded in beside me, and a third one settled on the arm of the chair. They seemed to eye each other, trying to figure out who had the best deal. They appeared to be full-grown, and probably from the same litter, as they all sported thick tortoiseshell coats and heads the size of softballs. There were 2 adolescent cats curled up in the other chair, a buff and a black, tangled together like mismatched socks. A 6th cat emerged from under the bed and paused, pointing each hind foot in turn. Gus watched this feline activity with a shy smile, his face flushed with pride.
"Aren't they great?" he said. "I just never get tired of these little peckerheads. At night they pile on the bed with me like a quilt. I got one sleeps on my pillow with his feet in my hair. I can kiss their little faces any time I want."
He snatched one up and cradled it like a baby, an indignity the cat endured with surprising passivity.
"How many do you have?" 6 right now, but Lucy Baines and Linda Bird are both pregnant. I don't know what I'm going to do about that."
"Maybe you could get them fixed," I said helpfully.
"Well, after this batch is born, I guess I should. I'm real good at finding homes for the kittens, though, and they're always so sweet."
I wanted to mention how good they smelled, too, but I didn't have the heart for sarcasm when he was clearly so crazy about his brood. There he was, looking like a police artist's composite of a sex killer, making a fool of himself over this collection of domesticated furs.
"I guess I should have spoken up sooner about this stuff," he was saying. "I don't know what got into me."
He crossed to the bookshelf and sorted through the mess on top, coming up with an address book about the size of a playing card, which he held out to me. I took it, leafing through.
"What's the significance? Did Bobby fill you in?"
"Well, no. He told me to keep it, and he said it was important, but he didn't explain. I just assumed it must be a list or a code. Some kind of information he had, but I don't know what."
"When did he give you this?"
"I don't remember exactly. It was sometime before the accident. He stopped over one day and gave it to me and asked me if I'd just hold on to it for him, so I said sure. I'd forgotten all about it until you brought it up."
I checked the index tab for B. There wasn't a Blackman listed there, but I did find the name penciled beside the back cover, with a 7-digit number beside it. No area code indicated, so it was probably local, though I didn't think it matched the number for S. Blackman I'd found in the telephone book.
"What did he actually say at the time?" I asked.
I knew I was repeating myself, but I kept hoping to solicit some indication of Bobby's intent.
"Nothing, really. He wanted me to hang on to it, is all. He didn't tell you either, huh?"
I shook my head. "He couldn't remember. He knew it was important, but he had no idea why. Have you ever heard the name Blackman? S. Blackman? Anybody Blackman?"
"Nope."
The cat was squirming, and he put it down.
"I understand Bobby had fallen in love with someone. I wonder if it might have been this S. Blackman."
"If it was, he didn't tell me. A couple of times he did meet some woman down at the beach, right out in that parking lot by the skate shack."
"Before the accident or afterwards?"
"Before. He'd sit in his Porsche and wait, and she'd pull in, and then they'd talk."
"He never introduced you or mentioned who she was?"
"I know what she looked like, but not her name. I saw him go in the coffee shop once, and she was built odd, you know? Kind of like a munchkin. I couldn't figure that out. Bobby was a good-looking guy, and he always hung out with these real foxy chicks. But she was a dog."
"Blonde, wispy hair? Maybe 45?
"I never saw her up close, so I don't know about her age, but the hair sounds right. She drives this Mercedes I see around now and then. Dark green with a beige interior. Looks like a 55 or 56, but it's in great shape."
I glanced through the address book again. Sufi's address and telephone number were listed under the D's. Had he been having an affair with her? It seemed so unlikely. Bobby had been 23 years old and, as Gus said, a good-looking kid. Carrie St. Cloud had mentioned a blackmailing scheme, but if Sufi was being blackmailed by someone, why would she turn to him for help? Surely it wasn't a matter of her blackmailing him. Whatever it was, it gave me a lead, and I was grateful for that. I tucked the book in my handbag and looked up. Gus was watching me with amusement.
"God, you should see your face. I could really watch the old wheels turn," he said.
"Things are beginning to happen, and I like that," I said. "Listen, this has been a big help. I don't know what it means yet, but believe me, I'll figure it out."
"I hope so. I'm just sorry I didn't speak up when you asked. If there's anything else I can do, just let me know."
"Thanks," I said. I shifted the cat off my lap and got up, shaking hands with him. I went out to my car, brushing at my jeans, picking cat hair off my lip. It was now 10 o'clock at night, and I should have headed home, but I was feeling wired. The episode at Moses and the sudden appearance of Bobby's address book were acting on me like a stimulant. I wanted to talk to Sufi. Maybe I'd stop by her place. If she was up, we could have a little chat. She'd tried once to steer me away from this investigation, and I wondered now what that was about. Chapter 19. I pulled into the shadows across the street from Sufi's place on Holland Road in the heart of Santa Teresa. For the most part, the houses I had passed were 2-story frame and stone on large lots complete with junipers and oaks. Many lawns sported the ubiquitous California crop of alarm company signs, warning of silent surveillance and armed patrols. Sufi's yard was darkened by the interlacing tree branches overhead. The property stretching back in a tangle of shrubs and surrounded by a picket fence with wide pales. The house was done in a dark shingle siding, possibly a muted brown or green, though it was hard to tell which at this hour of the night. The side porch was narrow and deeply recessed, with no exterior light visible. A dark green Mercedes was parked in the drive to the left. It was a quiet neighborhood. The sidewalks were deserted and there was no traffic. I got out of my car and crossed to the front of the house. Up close, I could see that the place was massive, the kind being converted now to bed and breakfast establishments with odd names, the Gull and Satchel, the Blue Tern, the Quackery. They're all over town these days, renovated Victorian mansions, impossibly quaint, where for $90 a night you can sleep in a bed with a fake brass frame and struggle the next morning with a freshly baked croissant that will drop pastry flakes in your lap like dandruff. From the look of it, Sufi's was still a single-family dwelling, but it had a shabby air. Maybe, like many single women her age, she'd reached that point where the absence of a man translates out to dripping faucets and rain gutters in need of repair. A single woman my age would haul out a crescent wrench or shinny up the downspout, feeling that odd joyousness that comes with self-sufficiency. Sufi had let her property decline to a state of lingering disrepair, and it made me wonder what she did with her salary. I thought surgical nurses made good money. At the rear of the house, there was a glass-enclosed porch, the windows flickering with the blue-gray reflections of a television set. I fumbled my way up several crumbling concrete steps and tapped on the door. After a moment, the porch light came on, and Sufi looked through the curtain. "Hi, it's me," I said. "Can I talk to you?" She leaned closer to the glass, peering around, apparently checking to see whether I was accompanied by roving bands of thugs. She opened the door in her robe and slippers, clutching the lapels together at her throat, one arm circling her waist. "Oh, my God, you scared me to death," she said. "What are you doing here at this hour? Is something wrong?" "Not at all. Sorry to alarm you. I was in the neighborhood and I needed to talk to you. Can I come in?"
"I was on my way to bed. We can talk out here on the porch, then."
She gave me a grudging look, stepping back reluctantly so I could enter. She was half a head shorter than I, and her blonde hair was so thin I could see stretches of scalp underneath. I hadn't pegged her as the type who'd lounge around in a slinky peach satin wrapper and matching mules with dandelion fuzz across the instep. This was hotsy-totsy stuff. I wanted to say, "Hubba hubba," but I was afraid she'd take offense. Once inside, I took a quick mental picture and stored it away for future assessment. The room was cluttered, disorganized, and probably unclean, judging from the used dishes piled here and there, the dead flowers in a vase, and the wastebasket spilling trash out onto the floor. The water in the bottom of the vase was cloudy with bacteria and probably smelled like the last stages of some disease. There was a crumpled cellophane packet on the arm of the easy chair, and I saw that she'd been sneaking ding-dongs. A Reader's Digest condensed book was open face down on the ottoman. The place smelled like a pepperoni pizza, some of which I spied sitting in a box on top of the television set. The heat from the circuitry was keeping it warm, the scent of oregano and mozzarella cheese mingling with the odor of hot cardboard. God, I thought, when did I last eat? "You live alone?" I asked. She looked at me as if I were casing the joint.
"What of it?"
"I've been assuming you were single. I just realized no one had ever really said as much."
"It's very late to be doing a survey," she said tartly. "What did you want?"
I find it so liberating when other people are rude. It makes me feel mild and lazy and mean. I smiled at her. "I found Bobby's address book."
"Why tell me?"
"I was curious about your relationship with him."
"I didn't have a relationship with him."
"That's not what I hear."
"Well, you heard wrong. Of course, I knew him. He was Glenn's only child, and she and I are best friends and have been for years. Aside from that, Bobby and I didn't have that much to say to one another."
"Why'd you need to meet him down at the beach, then?"
"I never met Bobby at the beach," she snapped.
"Somebody saw you with him on more than one occasion." She hesitated.
"Maybe I ran into him once or twice. What's wrong with that? I used to see him at the hospital, too."
I wondered what you talked about, that's all.
I'm sure we talked about lots of things, she said.
I could see her shifting gears, trying another tack. Some of the huffiness dropped away. She'd apparently decided to roll out the charm.
God, I don't know what's the matter with me. I'm sorry if I sounded rude. As long as you're here, you might as well sit down. I have wine chilled if you want some.
I'd like that, thanks.
She left the room, probably grateful for the chance to stall while she figured out how to cover her tracks. For my part, I was delighted with the opportunity to nose around. I crossed in haste to the easy chair, checking the table beside it. The top was littered with things I didn't want to touch. I eased the drawer open. The interior looked like a catch-all for household fallout. Batteries, candles, an extension cord, receipts, rubber bands, packets of matches, two buttons, a sewing kit, pencils, junk mail, a dinner fork, a stapler gun, all of it surrounded by accumulated grit. I ran a hand down along the chair cushion and came up with a nickel, which I left there. I heard the chirp of a wine cork in the kitchen and the tinkle of wine glasses as she removed them from a cabinet. The glass rims began to clink together as she moved back toward the TV room. I abandoned my search and perched myself casually on the arm of the couch. I was trying to think of something nice to say about her house, but I was secretly worried about my tetanus shots being out of date. This was the kind of place, if you had to use the john, you'd want to put paper down on the seat.
Quite a house, I remarked.
Sufi made a face.
The cleaning lady comes tomorrow, she said. Not that she does much. She worked for my parents for years, and I don't have the heart to let her go.
Do they live with you? She shook her head.
Dead. Cancer.
Both of them?
That's the way it goes, she said with a shrug.
So much for family sentiment. She poured a glass of wine and handed it to me. I could tell from the label it was the same ultra-crummy stuff I drank before I got into the boxed brand with the picture of a phony-looking vineyard on the front. Clearly neither of us had the budget or the palate for anything decent. She settled into the easy chair, wine glass in hand. The change in her manner was conspicuous. She must have come up with a good one while she was gone. She took a sip of wine, staring at me over the rim of her glass.
"Have you talked to Derek lately?" she asked.
"He stopped by my office this afternoon."
"He moved out. When Glenn got back from San Francisco this evening, she had the maid pack his bags and put them out in the driveway. Then she changed the locks."
"My, my," I said. "I wonder what brought that on."
You'd be smart to talk to him before you worry about me.
Why's that?
He had a motive for killing Bobby. I didn't, if that's what you're getting at.
What motive are you referring to?
Glenn discovered he'd taken out a big life insurance policy on Bobby 18 months ago.
What? My wine glass tipped and wine slopped out on my hand. I couldn't disguise the fact that I was startled, but I didn't like the smug look that crossed her face in response.
Oh, yes. The insurance company tracked her down to ask for a copy of the death certificate. I guess the agent read about Bobby in the paper and remembered the name. That's how Glenn found out.
I thought you couldn't take out a policy on someone without their signature.
Technically that's true, but it can be done.
I busied myself wiping up spilled wine with a tissue. In the midst of the mop-up procedure, I realized, like a cartoon light bulb going on overhead, that she felt an intense dislike for Derek.
"What's the story?" I asked. "Derek got caught with his pants down," she said. "His claim is that he got the policy ages ago, after Bobby'd totaled his car a couple of times. He thought Bobby would self-destruct. You know the type, one accident after another until the kid winds up dead. It becomes a socially acceptable form of suicide. Personally, I'm not sure Derek was that far off. Bobby drank like a fish, and I'm sure he did drugs. He and Kitty were both a mess, rich and spoiled and self-indulgent.
Be careful what you say here, Sufi. I liked Bobby Callahan. I think he had guts.
I think we're well aware of that, she said.
She was using that superior tone of voice that drove me mad, but I couldn't afford to react at this point. She crossed her legs, swinging one foot. The dandelion fuzz on that slipper undulated as the air passed over it.
"You may not like it, but it is the truth, and that's not all of it. Word has it that Derek took out a policy on Kitty, too."
"For how much?"
$500,000 on each.
Come on, Sufi, that doesn't make any sense. Derek wouldn't kill his own daughter.
Kitty isn't dead, though, is she?
But why would he kill Bobby?
He'd have to be nuts. The first thing the cops are going to do is turn around and look at him.
Kinsey, she said patiently, nobody ever said Derek had brains. He's an idiot, a fool.
He's not that big a fool, I said. How could he hope to get away with it?
Nobody's got any proof that he did anything. There never was any evidence from the first accident, and Jim Fraker seems to think this one came about because Bobby had a seizure first. How can they pin that on Derek?
But why would he do it? He's got money.
Glenn's got money. Derek doesn't have a dime. He'd go for anything that would get him out from under her. Don't you know that?
All I could do was stare at her, running the information through my mental computer. She took another sip of wine and smiled at me, loving the effect she'd produced. Finally, I said, I just don't believe it.
You can believe anything you like. All I'm saying is you better check that out before you do anything else.
You don't like Derek, do you?
Of course not. I think he's the biggest ass who ever lived. I don't know what Glenn saw in him in the first place. He's poor, he's dumb, he's pompous, and those are his good qualities, she said with energy. Aside from all that, he's ruthless.
He doesn't seem ruthless to me, I said.
You haven't known him as long as I have. He's a man who'd do anything for money, and I suspect he's got lots he's not anxious to discuss. Doesn't he strike you as a man with a past?
Like what?
I'm not sure, but I'd be willing to bet you his buffoonery is just a cover for something else.
Are you saying Glenn's been hoodwinked? She seems smarter than that.
She's smart about everything but men. This is her third time around, you know, and Bobby's father was a mess. Husband number two I don't know about. She was living in Europe when she married him, and it didn't last long. Let's get back to you for a minute. The day of Bobby's funeral, I got the impression you were trying to steer me away from the investigation. Now you're giving me leads. Why the switch?
She had to stop and pay attention to the tie on her robe, though she was talking to me the whole time.
I guess I thought you'd be prolonging Glenn's pain and heartache, she said, looking up at me then. It's clear now that nothing I say is going to dissuade you in any event, so I might as well tell you what I know.
Why'd you meet Bobby down at the beach? What was going on?
Oh, pooh, nothing, she said. I ran into him a couple of times, and he wanted to bitch about Derek. Bobby couldn't stand him either, and he knew I made a good audience. That's all it amounted to.
Why didn't you say that in the first place?
I'm not accountable to you. You show up at my door uninvited and quiz me about all this bullshit. It's none of your business, so why should I answer to you? I don't think you know how you come off sometimes.
I felt myself flush at the well-placed insult. I drank the last of my wine. I was having trouble believing her story about meeting Bobby, but it was clear I wasn't going to get much more out of her. I decided to drop it for the moment, but it didn't sit well with me. If she'd only been listening to his complaints, why not just say so to begin with? A glance at my watch showed that it was just after 11, and I decided to try to catch Glenn at home. I excused myself abruptly and got out. I'm sure the haste of my departure wasn't lost on her. There are times when things begin to break by sheer dint of dumb luck. I don't pretend to take credit for what happened next. By the time I got to my little VW, I realized how chilly it was. I hopped in and shut the door, locking it as is my habit, and then I turned and started rooting around in my junky back seat for a sweatshirt I'd tossed back there. I just laid my hands on it, and I was in the process of hauling it out from under a pile of books when I heard a car start up. I glanced to my right. Sufi's Mercedes was being backed out of the driveway. I did a quick surface dive, disappearing from view. I wasn't sure if she knew my car or not, but she must have assumed I was gone because she pulled straight off. As soon as she did, I rolled into the driver's seat, fumbling for my keys. I started the car and did a quick U-turn, catching a glimpse of her taillights as she hung a right, heading toward State Street. She couldn't have had time enough to change her clothes. At best, she might have thrown a coat over her satin lounging outfit. Who did she know well enough to visit unannounced in a Jean Harlow get-up at this hour of the night? I couldn't wait to see.
Chapter 20. In Santa Teresa, the rich are divided into two cliques. Half live in Montebello, half in Horton Ravine. Montebello is the old money, Horton Ravine the new. Both communities have acres of old trees, bridle paths, and country clubs requiring proper sponsorship and entrance fees of 25 grand. Both communities discourage fundamentalist churches, tacky yard ornaments, and door-to-door sales. Sufi was headed for Horton Ravine. As she passed through the main gates on Los Piratas, she slowed to 30 miles an hour, reluctant perhaps to get picked up for speeding while dressed like a call girl on her way to a John. I slowed my car at a pace with hers, hanging back as far as I could. I was worried about having to pursue her along miles of winding road, but she surprised me by turning into one of the first driveways on the right. The house was set back about 100 yards, a one-story California bungalow. Maybe 5 bedrooms, 4,000 square feet, not remarkable to look at, but expensive nevertheless. The property was probably 5 acres all told, surrounded by an ornamental split-rail fence, with rambling roses laid along its length. Exterior lights had come on when Sufi's Mercedes reached the house. She got out of the car in a blur of peach satin and mink, moving toward the front door, which opened and swallowed her up. I had passed the house by then. I drove on as far as the first road on the right, where I did a turnaround, dousing my headlights as I drifted back. I parked my car on the berm on the left-hand side, hugging some shrubs. The area was shrouded in darkness, no streetlights at all. Across from me, the tag end of the golf course was visible, and the narrow artificial lake that served as a water hazard. Moonlight glimmered on the surface of the lake, making it as glossy as a remnant of gray silk. I removed the flashlight from the glove compartment and got out of my car, picking my way carefully through the tall grass growing by the road. It was thick and wet, soaking my tennis shoes and the legs of my jeans. I reached the driveway. There wasn't any name on the mailbox, but I noted the numbers. I could always stop by my office and check my crisscross directory if I needed to. I had gone about halfway up the drive when I heard a dog barking at the house. I had no idea what kind it was, but it sounded big. One of those dogs that knows how to bark from its balls. Deep, business-like barks, suggestive of sharp teeth and a bad attitude. Furthermore, that sucker had picked up my scent and was anxious to make contact. There was no way I could creep any closer without alerting the occupants of the house. They were probably already wondering what was making old dog Trey wet himself with excitement. For all I knew, they'd release him from his 3/8-inch chain and send him flying down the driveway after me, toenails scratching along the blacktop. I've been chased by dogs before, and it's not that much fun. I reversed my course and got back in the car. Common sense is no disgrace in the private eye trade. I watched the house for an hour, but there was no sign of activity. I was getting tired, and this felt like a waste of time. Finally, I started the engine and eased the car into gear, not flipping on my headlights until I was out through the gate again. By the time I got home, I was exhausted. I made a few quick notes and packed it in for the night. It was nearly 1 o'clock when I finally turned out the light. I got up at 6 and did a 3-mile run just to get my head on straight. Then I sped through my morning ablutions, grabbed an apple, and arrived at the office by 7. It was Tuesday, and I was thankful I wasn't scheduled for physical therapy that day. Now that I thought about it, my arm was feeling pretty good. Or maybe the fact that I was involved in an investigation distracted me from whatever pain or immobility remained. There were no messages on my answering machine, and no mail that needed dealing with from the day before. I hauled out my crisscross and checked the house numbers on Los Piratas. Well, well. I should have guessed. Fraker, James, and Nola. I wondered which of them Sufi had gone to see, and why the rush. It was possible, of course, that she'd consulted with both, but I couldn't quite picture that. Could Nola be the woman Bobby'd fallen in love with? I couldn't see how Dr. Fraker tied into this, but something was sure going on. I took out Bobby's address book and tried the number for Blackman. I got a recorded message from that woman who sounds like the fairy godmother in a Walt Disney cartoon.
We're sorry, but the number you've dialed cannot be connected in the 805 area code. Please check the number and dial again. Thank you.
I tried the codes for surrounding areas. No luck. I spent a long time looking through the other entries in the book. If all else failed, I'd have to sit here and contact each person in turn. But it seemed like a tiresome prospect and not necessarily productive. In the meantime, what? It was too early in the morning to make house calls, but it occurred to me that a visit to Kitty might make sense. She was still at St. Terry's, and given hospital routine, she'd probably been roused out of bed at dawn. I hadn't seen her for days anyway, and she might be of help. The chill of the day before was gone. The air was clear, and the sun was already intense. I slid my VW into the last available space in the visitor's lot and went around to the front entrance. The information desk in the lobby was deserted, but the hospital itself was in full swing. The coffee shop was jammed, the scent of cholesterol and caffeine wafting irresistibly through the open doorway. Lights were on in the gift shop. The cashier's office was busy, filled with young female clerks preparing final bills, as if this were some grand hotel nearing checkout time. There was an aura of excitement, medical personnel gearing up for birth and death and complex surgeries, cracked bones and breakdowns and drug overdoses, 100 life-threatening episodes any given day of the week, and through it all the insidious sexuality that made it the stuff of soaps. I went up to the third floor, turning left when I got off the elevators near 3 South. The big double doors were locked, as usual. I pushed the buzzer. After a moment, a heavy-set black woman in jeans and a royal blue T-shirt rattled some keys and opened the door a crack. She wore a nursey, no-nonsense watch and those shoes with 2-inch crepe soles designed to offset fallen arches and varicose veins. She had startling hazel eyes and a face that radiated competence. Her white plastic tag indicated that her name was Natalie Jacks, LVN. I showed Ms. Jacks the photostat of my license and asked if I could talk to Kitty Wenner, explaining that I was a friend of the family. She looked my ID over carefully and finally stepped back to let me in. She locked the door behind me and led the way down the corridor to a room near the end. I was sneaking peeks into rooms along the way. I don't know what I anticipated. Women writhing and babbling to themselves, men imitating ex-presidents and jungle beasts, or the lot of them in a drug-induced stupor that would swell their tongues and make their eyes roll back in their heads. Instead, as I passed each door, I saw faces raised in curiosity toward mine, as if I were a new admission who might shriek or do bird calls while I tore off my clothes. I couldn't see any difference between them and me, which I thought was worrisome. Kitty was up and dressed, her hair still wet from a shower. She was stretched out on her bed, pillows propped up behind her, a breakfast tray on the bed table next to her. She wore a silk caftan that drooped on her frame as if she were a coat hanger. Her breasts were no bigger than buttons on a couch, and her arms were bare bones fleshed out with skin as thin as tissue paper. Her eyes were enormous and haunted, the shape of her skull so pronounced that she looked as if she were 70. Sally Struthers could have used her picture in an ad for foster parenting. "You got a visitor," Natalie said. Kitty's eyes flicked to me, and for a moment I could see how scared she was. She was dying. She had to know that. The energy was seeping out of her pores like sweat. Natalie inspected the breakfast tray.
"You know they're going to put you on an IV if you don't do better than this. I thought you had a contract with Dr. Kleinert."
"I ate some," Kitty said.
"Well, I'm not supposed to pester you, but he'll be doing rounds soon. Try picking away at this while you talk to her, okay?" "We're on your team, baby. Honestly."
Natalie gave us both a brief smile and left, moving into the room next door, where we could hear her talking to someone else. Kitty's face was suffused with pink, and she was fighting back tears. She reached for a cigarette and lit it, coughing some against the back of her bony hand. She shook her head, conjuring up a smile that had some sweetness to it.
"God, I can't believe I got myself into this," she said, and then wistfully,
You think Glenn might come see me?
I don't know. I may go over there after I talk to you. I'll mention it to her if you like.
She kicked Daddy out.
So I heard.
She'll probably kick me out next.
I couldn't look at her anymore. Her longing for Glenn was so tangible it hurt me to see it. I studied the breakfast tray. A fresh fruit cup, a blueberry muffin, a carton of strawberry yogurt, granola, orange juice, tea. There was no indication that she'd eaten any of it.
"You want some of that?" she asked.
"No way. You'll tell Kleinert you ate it." Kitty had the good grace to blush, laughing uneasily. "I don't understand why you don't eat," I said. She made a face.
"Everything just looks so gross. There's this girl two doors down, and she was suffering from anorexia, you know? So they brought her in here, and she finally started to eat. Now she looks like she's pregnant. She's still thin. She's just got half a basketball for a stomach. It's disgusting."
"So what? She's alive, isn't she?"
"I don't want to look like that. Nothing tastes good anyway, and it just makes me throw up."
There was no point in pursuing the subject, so I let it go, shifting over to something else instead. "Have you talked to your father since Glenn kicked him out?" Kitty shrugged.
"He's here every day in the afternoon. He moved into the Edgewater Hotel until he finds a place."
"Did he tell you about Bobby's will?"
"Some. He says Bobby left me all this money." "Is that true?"
Her tone was one of dismay as much as anything. "As far as I know, it is."
"But why would he do that?"
"Maybe he felt like he messed up your life and wanted to do right by you. Derek tells me he left some money to Rick's parents, too. Or maybe he considered it a little incentive for you to get your shit together for a change."
"I never made any deals with him."
"I don't think he meant to make a deal."
"Well, I don't like to feel controlled."
"Kitty, I think you've demonstrated the fact that you can't be controlled."
"We're all getting that message loud and clear.
Bobby loved you."
"Who asked him to? Sometimes I wasn't even nice to him, and I didn't exactly have his best interests at heart."
"Meaning what?"
"Nothing, skip it. I wish he hadn't left me anything, is all. It makes me feel crummy."
"I don't know what to tell you," I said.
"Well, I never asked him for a thing."
Her tone was argumentative, but I couldn't understand what her position was.
"What's bothering you?"
"Nothing."
"What's all the fretting about, then?"
"I'm not fretting. God, why would I fret? He did it so he'd feel good, right? It had nothing to do with me."
"It had something to do with you, or he'd have left the money to someone else."
She started gnawing on her thumbnail, temporarily abandoning the cigarette, which sat on the lip of the ashtray and sent up a tiny trail of smoke like an Indian signal on a distant mountain top. Her mood was getting dark. I wasn't sure why she was so upset at the notion of $2 million being dumped in her lap, but I didn't want to alienate her. I wanted information. I shifted the subject again.
"What about the insurance your father took out on Bobby's life? Did he mention that?"
"Yeah, that's weird. He does stuff like that, and later he can't understand why people get upset. He doesn't see anything wrong with it at all. To him it just makes sense. Bobby'd cracked up his car once or twice, so Daddy just figured if he died, somebody might as well benefit. I guess that's why Glenn threw him out, huh?"
"I think that's a safe bet. She'd never tolerate his profiting from Bobby's death. My God, it was the worst possible move he could have made as far as she's concerned. Besides which, it sets him up as a murder suspect."
"My father wouldn't kill anyone."
"That's what he says about you."
"Well, it's true. I didn't have any reason to want Bobby dead. Neither of us did. I didn't even know about the money, and I don't want it anyway."
"Money might not be the motive," I said. "It's an obvious place to start, but it doesn't necessarily go anywhere."
"But you don't think Daddy did it, do you?"
"I haven't made up my mind about that yet. I'm still trying to figure out what Bobby was up to, and I need to fill in some gaps. Something was going on back then, and I can't get a line on it. What was his relationship to Sufi? You have any idea?"
Kitty picked up her cigarette, averting her gaze. She took a moment to tap the ash from the end, and then she took a last, deep drag and put it out.
Her nails were bitten down so far the pads of the fingers seemed like little round balls. She was debating something with herself. I kept my mouth shut and gave her some room.
"She was a contact," she said finally, her voice low. "Bobby was doing this investigation or something for somebody else."
"Who?"
"I don't know."
"It had to be the Frakers, right?" "I talked to Sufi last night, and the minute I left, she hightailed it over to their place. She was in there so long, I finally had to go home." Kitty's eyes came up to mine.
"I don't know for sure what it was."
"But how'd he get into it? What was it about?"
"All I know is he told me he was looking for something, and he got that job out at the morgue so he could search at night."
"Medical records? Something stored out there?" Her face closed down again, and she shrugged. "But, Kitty, when you realized someone was trying to kill him, didn't you figure it was connected to that?" She was chewing on her thumbnail in earnest by now. I saw her eyes flick, and I turned around. Dr. Kleinert was standing in the doorway, staring at her. When he realized I'd seen him, he looked over at me. His smile seemed forced, and it was not full of merriment.
"Well, I didn't know you were entertaining this morning," he said to her, then briefly to me. "What brings you in so bright and early?"
"I just stopped by on my way to Glenn's. I've been trying to persuade Kitty to eat," I said.
"No need for that," he said easily. "This young lady has an agreement with me."
He gave a practiced glance at his watch, adjusting the face of it on his wrist before it disappeared up his cuff again.
"I hope you'll excuse us. I have other patients to see, and my time is limited."
"I'm on my way out," I said. I glanced at Kitty. "I may give you a call in a little while. I'll see if Glenn can stop in to visit you."
"Great," she said. "Thanks."
I waved and moved out of the room, wondering how long he'd been standing there and how much he'd heard. I was trying to remember what Carrie St. Cloud had said.
"She told me Bobby was involved in some kind of blackmail scheme, but not the usual kind with money changing hands. Something else.
Somebody had something on some friend of his, and he was trying to help out," was the way she'd put it, as nearly as I could remember. If it was extortion, why didn't he go to the police? And why was it up to him to do anything? I got back in my car and headed out to Glenn's place.
End of Disc 5. Disc 6.
Chapter 21. It was just after 9 when I pulled into Glenn's driveway. The courtyard was deserted. The fountain sent up a column of water 15 feet high, cascading back on itself in a tumble of pale green and white. I could hear a power mower whining from one of the terraces in the rear, and rainbirds were jetting a fine spray into the giant fern, dappled with sunlight, that bordered the gravel walks. The air seemed tropical, scented with jasmine. I rang the bell, and one of the maids admitted me. I asked for Glenn, and she murmured something in Spanish, raising her eyes to the second floor. I gathered that Glenn was upstairs. The door to Bobby's room was open, and she was seated in one of his easy chairs, hands in her lap, her face impassive. When she caught sight of me, she smiled almost imperceptibly. She was looking drawn, dark lines etched under her eyes. Her makeup was subtle, but it only seemed to emphasize the pallor in her cheeks. She wore a knit dress in a shade of red too harsh for her.
"Hello, Kinsey. Come sit down," she said.
I sat in the matching plaid chair.
"How are you doing?"
"Not that well. I find myself spending much of the day up here. Just sitting. Waiting for Bobby."
Her eyes strayed to mine.
"I don't mean that literally, of course. I'm far too rational a person to believe the dead return. I keep thinking there's something more, that it can't be over yet. Do you know what I mean?"
"No, not quite." She stared at the floor, apparently consulting her inner voices.
"Part of it is a feeling of betrayal, I think. I was brave, and I did everything I was supposed to do. I was a trooper, and now I want the payoff. But the only reward that interests me is having Bobby back. So I wait.
Her gaze moved around the room as if she were taking a series of photographs. Her manner seemed very flat to me, despite the emotional content of her speech. It was curious, like talking to a robot. She said human things, but mechanically.
You see that?
I followed her eyes. Bobby's footprints were still visible on the white carpeting.
I won't let them vacuum in here, she said. I know it's stupid. I don't want to turn into one of those dreadful women who erect a shrine for the dead, keeping everything just as it was. But I don't want him erased. I don't want him wiped out like that. I don't even want to go through his belongings.
There's no need to do anything yet, is there?
No, I guess not. I don't know what I'll do with a room anyway. I have dozens, and they're all empty. It's not like I need to convert it into a sewing room or a studio.
Are you taking care of yourself otherwise?
Oh, yes, I know enough to do that. I feel like grief is an illness I can't recover from. What worries me is I notice there's a certain attraction to the process that's hard to give up. It's painful, but at least it allows me to feel close to him. Once in a while I catch myself thinking of something else, and then I feel guilty. It seems disloyal not to hurt, disloyal to forget even for a moment that he's gone.
Don't get mean with yourself and suffer more than you have to, I said.
I know. I'm trying to wean myself. Every day I mourn a little less, like giving up cigarettes. In the meantime, I pretend to be a whole person, but I'm not. I wish I could think of something that would heal me. Oh, God, I shouldn't go on and on about it. It's like someone who's had a heart attack or major surgery. It's all I can talk about. So self-centered.
Again she paused, and then she seemed to remember polite behavior. She looked at me.
What have you been doing?
I went over to St. Terry's this morning to see Kitty.
Oh?
Glenn's expression was devoid of interest. Is there any chance you might stop by to see her?
Absolutely none. For one thing, I'm furious that she's alive while Bobby's not. I hate it that he left her all that money. As far as I'm concerned, she's grasping, self-destructive, manipulative.
She broke off, closing her mouth. She was silent for a moment.
Sorry. I don't mean to be so vehement. I never liked her. Just because she's in trouble now doesn't change anything. She's done it to herself. She thought there'd always be someone who'd bail her out, but it won't be me. And Derek's not capable of it.
I heard he left. She stirred restlessly.
We had a terrible fight. I didn't think I'd ever get him out of here. I finally had to call one of the gardeners. I despise him, truly. It makes me sick to think he was ever in my bed. I don't know which is worse, the fact that he took out that ghoulish policy on Bobby's life, or the fact that he hadn't the faintest sense how despicable it was.
Can he collect?
He seems to think so, but I intend to fight him every step of the way. I've put the insurance company on notice, and I've contacted a firm of lawyers.